A remarkable exhibit of art will be coming to not one, but two area venues beginning in July. About 200 works of art that have captured the spirit and essence of Vermont, drawn from the personal collection of Lyman Orton, the proprietor of the Vermont Country Store in Weston, will be on display at the Bennington Museum and the Southern Vermont Arts Center in Manchester. Titled For the Love of Vermont, the Bennington end of the exhibit will have a soft opening on July 1st, with the opening reception on July 15th. In Manchester, their share of the exhibit, which will have the majority of the paintings on display, will open on July 22nd. The artwork will be on display in both venues until November 5th. The Orton collection consists primarily of works done between 1920 and 1970 and features artists such as Rockwell Kent, Luigi Lucioni, John Clymer, Mead Schaefer, Milton Avery, and many others. The images cover iconic Vermont landscapes, covered bridges, farming and family life, and also evoke a Vermont that may live in many folks' imaginations, but are also not far removed from today. It will be a massive exhibit, which will occupy all of the gallery space at the Esther House at the Southern Vermont Arts Center. To learn more about the exhibit and how it came to be, we sat down for an extended interview with Lyman Orton at the Vermont Country Store's corporate offices in Manchester, along with Anita Raphael, a Vermont writer who produced an accompanying book about the exhibit, which will be available to the public.
You know, what really I started was going to auctions, not as a kid, but as a young man, and looking for furniture for my new house that I'd bought in 1965 in Weston, you know. So I had, you know, a few pieces from the folks and six or eight beanbag chairs. And so then we all went to auctions. And so I'd buy something, you know, and look for a dining table, this, that, or the other thing. And because everybody, we were all interested in antiques in that era. And so then I began going to auctions with my dear friend Barbara Milhado, who was an appraiser and dealer and so on in art and antiques and highly knowledgeable. And so we started noticing that a lot of the paintings that were coming up at auctions were appearing to be sold to people out of state, you know, not that we can prove. But anyway, the idea was I should keep them here rather than let somebody else buy them and gosh knows where they're going to take them or send them or so on. So that was as simple as it was, that let's keep art in Vermont that was good art done during the essentially the 20th century. But the sweet spot of the 20th century that I focus on is the 1920s through the 1960s, and so which I call the golden era of art in Vermont. And that harks back to the beginning of the Southern Vermont Arts Center, to the Dorset painters, and to the amazing number of excellent painters in Vermont during those times. Now, the demographics and statistics don't add up to, it wouldn't be possible with the population to have all these painters of such excellence and so on, because as we all know, a lot of them moved up here. They come for the summer and then they stay for, you know, year round. So they didn't just pass through. It wasn't like a school. It was a gathering of people who came here because they loved Vermont, and their paintings demonstrate that and show that. And so they lived here. They raised their families here. 22 of them are buried in the Dorset Cemetery. So this was more than just a little hit and miss, and it evolved, as I said, into the Southern Vermont Arts Center. And so we have this amazing amount of excuse me of art that celebrates their love of Vermont, mimics my love of Vermont, and hopefully everybody in Vermont loves Vermont. It's one of those states, and that now we have something that we'll share for the first time with the with the public. This whole collection has never been shown in its entirety to the public.
But this is the first time that this many paintings will be seen from the Orton Collection. And what's interesting about it is that many of these came from private collections when he acquired them. So they're works that have never been seen by the public at all. But when you look at the roll call of who these artists are, in the book that we wrote and on the labels on the exhibition, those names are the artists who exhibited together nearly 100 years ago, and now here they are 100 years later exhibiting for the first time together again. So it's kind of like a reunion in a way of a great many of the Dorset painters, the painters from Bennington County, Windham County. But I also want to emphasize that there are many pieces in Lyman's collection that come from the northern counties, Essex County, Washington County, Chittenden County. It's not exclusively a collection of artists from southern Vermont, and that's what makes this particular exhibition really one of a kind, where it's going, I hate to say it, but it's going to be a once in a lifetime for people to see works of art that, I mean, just the fact that it's a private collection, you don't even have to say more than that. But this roll call of these artists who were so famous in New York, Chicago, Boston, came up here, spent a few quiet months, a few quiet years, maybe in the last years of their life painting, and here they are all together again. That's, to me, was the best part.
So what were the criteria that you both had to select the works? You've got, I think, 160 or so at the Art Center here in Manchester, and then another 50 or 60 in
Bennington Museum.
So what were the criteria in mind that made you think, this one should be in the show, but not this one?
Well, taking the broad stroke of the painters who came here, spent the summer, two or three would oddly come just in the winter, and they didn't come to ski, but that's another story. So once I was in this keep the great paintings of the primarily 20th century, keep them in Vermont and also repatriate them. And that's become a lot easier with the internet, finding paintings that have flown the coop that might be anywhere from California to Mississippi to who knows, and bringing them home. The choice that has to be made of, I decide, do I like a painting? I don't just buy a painting because a certain artist did it. I don't collect just for name artists. I collect for all the artists who especially lived here or visited for long periods of time. And some are more famous than others, but they all were doing it. And I particularly like to buy paintings that have a there. In other words, is it at all identifiable? I may not know where it is, but the public, somebody knows. So we keep finding out where a scene was, even if I don't recognize the scene. And so I buy what, if I think that we'll demonstrate that people will be interested in looking at. And the show and the book are organized not by artist, but by themes that we've come up with. And there's probably 15 sort of themes, from maple sugaring to
auctions,
churches,
village fairs,
covered bridges, that sort of thing. So we'll have, you'll be able to see at the show, say, our beloved covered bridges by a number of different artists. They aren't all painting the same covered bridge, but here, so that's a different way to look at it rather than just organize the show by artist, which then tends to create a hierarchy of, well, the known artist gets shown the most and so forth, and everybody else is delegated to the back room or whatever. So we think it's trying to make it a more egalitarian collection, which it is, and show, which it's also trying to reach beyond the usual showgoers or art aficionados or other collectors or experts, to expand the world of art shows and looking at art beyond just the experts, but to everyday folks. And because these are of Vermont, that's the thing that holds us all together and holds the paintings together. And you don't have to be shy about coming in and seeing this collection. You don't have to know anything about art. You don't have to be an expert. You know, the world of galleries and museums and so on can be a bit intimidating to a lot of people, but people don't feel necessarily comfortable. So we're trying to address that in how we put the show together. We're putting some nice informational signs with each painting that Anita and I have been putting together now for a couple of months, so that it'll be more educational and telling something more about the, you know, either the background or why I got this painting, or the little backstories to them. You know, you've been to many art shows, and there's a painting, and then there's a little tiny sign about that big. And if you're over 35, you probably can't read it because it's in tiny type. We've all experienced that. So we're all squinting through our bifocals trying to read the signs. It's not much help. So we're taking a different approach.
There's going to be a lot of comfortable familiarity in the galleries for the show. You know how a lot of people are intimidated to walk into an art museum or an art gallery? And if they can just get through the door, I guarantee you that once they're inside, there's going to be so much on the walls that's familiar to them. And it's going to be comforting. It's going to be reassuring. It's going to be verifying as to their tastes, as to their interests, as to their love of Vermont. It's all going to reinforce their feelings about Vermont. And that was very intentional, to create that kind of an environment where people don't walk in the door and go, oh, I really don't belong here. I really feel that there's something for everybody in this show, whether it's subject matter, whether it's just the way the paintings are hung, the way the paintings are labeled. I really feel that it can have a broader audience. We've just got to get them to overcome that thing of, oh, I never go to art museums, or oh, I don't like galleries, or I feel bad when I go to an art gallery. Somebody's looking down their nose at me. This is not that. From the minute you walk in the door, it's not that.
And will each venue or each gallery have sort of a cross-section of all the paintings, or will it be certain types of paintings in one place and certain ones in the other?
Let me answer
that. Yes. Anita, why don't you answer that?
I want to answer that. When the curators at each of the museums and the directors at Bennington Museum, it was Jamie Franklin, and the director, Martin Mahoney, and at Southern Vermont Art Center, it was Ann Corso and Allison Kreitz. They literally sat down with the entire inventory of paintings, and they flagged things that would work in either place or both places. So, for example, one of the painters in the collection is Cecil Crossley Bell. And there are two beautiful paintings by Cecil Crossley Bell of horses at the country fair doing the horse pull, where they pull big load of rocks or cement or whatever. And there are two of those, two different views. So one museum took one and the other took the other. So it was possible in many cases where there were two or more paintings by a certain artist to divide them up, you know, so some would have some and some would have the other. In cases where there was only one painting by a certain artist, that's where the selection got a little more difficult, because it was like, all right, there's only one of these, you know, how do we decide, you know, where it goes? So there was a lot of thought put in by the directors and the curators, particularly Jamie Franklin and Allison Kreitz, to how to make it not seem like either half is missing anything. So putting the two halves together, it's sort of like a synergy where it's more than it is when you just see either half. And I will say they did this thoughtfully and carefully, and there have been very little instances where we had to go back and fix their choices. It just really worked out because they put the effort into it.
We also had opportunities to talk with Allison Kreitz, the curator of the exhibit at the Southern Vermont Arts Center, and Jamie Franklin, who curated the exhibit at the Bennington Museum.
I think Lyman has actually been clear from the beginning of this project that it was important to him that we present his collection in a way that is really trying to intentionally engage our visitors and not make this a sort of traditionally very academic discussion of artwork and a feeling that you're coming to a place and maybe a bit overwhelmed by all the information, you know. So information overload was not a goal with this exhibition. Really thinking about what are the accessible ways to display and talk about the artwork for visitors. So Anita's work on the book with Lyman, it's just a very, just the way the story is told is extremely accessible. And that's the same sort of voice that she's bringing into the labels that she's writing for the exhibition. Similarly, we have different moments in the galleries where I think visitors will, quite frankly, sort of be surprised, be delighted, be awed by the artwork in the collection. We're doing these wonderful salon style hangings in two of the galleries, really to showcase. In one instance, it's all of the barn paintings from Lyman's collection that are at SVAC. So we're just covering a wall that's about 25 feet in length, and there'll be three, maybe even four rows of paintings across that wall. And so visitors can really just sort of like, I think just have a fun moment with it, and see all the variations of styles, artistic styles and media used to represent barns, which is a, very iconic image, of course, in Vermont art, in Vermont, literally. So I think sort of playing with our display techniques, we don't tend to do salon styles at SVAC. I think other examples are we have some moments in the gallery where visitors are invited to take selfies in front. We have sort of big murals, reproductions of images that will be on the walls and sort of invite people to interact with those spaces. We also have a response station plan in the galleries where visitors can share their stories and what they love about Vermont with us and hopefully take time to read other people's responses. And sort of, continue that conversation. So I think, I would say sort of that accessibility is the idea, the nugget that comes to mind as we think about an overarching goal for the exhibition, getting people maybe who are not regular museum goers to come to the museum, as well as, of course, our members and our, community who visit us regularly, just having this chance to see an exhibition and see us testing out some ways of displaying and interpreting the art that we haven't done before.
Then we went down to the Bennington Museum, where we met up with Jamie Franklin, the curator who is working on the exhibit down there.
Kind of, whenever you're working on a large project like this with a lot of partners, it's about communication. And I think one of the things that we probably spent the most time thinking about and working on is how we can share the collection in a way that really reflects Lyman's kind of approach as a collector and the subject matter that he was going after, how and why he collects. So really incorporating his voice and his sensibility, not just into the selection of work, because obviously we're picking works from his collection, and so that's, but kind of how he uses his work to tell stories. And, we work with Anita, obviously, on that to really help kind of bring in Lyman's voice. He's quoted in a lot of the exhibition labels. So, you can hear him telling stories about auctioneers when you're looking at a painting of auctions. I mean, I've been working with Lyman in my position here at the museum, in various capacities for, probably almost 15 years now, not quite. We started connecting over his interest in the artist Rockwell Kent. We have a couple of his pieces here in this exhibit, and as well as a couple up in Manchester. And you know, our interests as an institution and his interests as a collector align kind of perfectly. So, but really, it's about kind of Vermont's history and culture of art and the things that they were depicting. So, you know, we've got the exhibition both here in Manchester, here in Bennington, and up in Manchester, arranged in kind of four loose thematic groups that kind of reflect the themes and ideas that come out in a lot of the work. So there's a section called Picture Country, which was actually drawn from a 1940s publicity brochure. And it's basically landscape painting, you know, and that's one of the things that was the big draw for artists during the 20th century. You know, Vermont had and still has, luckily, incredible natural beauty. And so that section reflects that. Then there is Village Beautiful, and Village Beautiful was a term that was coined in the 19th century by the owner of a hotel just south of the border in Williamstown, Massachusetts, at the Greylock Hotel. And it was basically, a way to describe the kind of aesthetic and cultural beauty of New England's small villages. And a lot of the work in Lyman's collection reflects that. They're images of small village life here in southern Vermont, from, you know, Pollitt, Putney, to Newfane, one of the Newfanes. You know, little kind of vignettes of village life with the historic architecture, bridges, churches, meeting houses, country stores. And then the exhibition kind of moves into a section called Making a Living, you know, depictions of kind of traditional ways of making a living here in Vermont, from logging. Of course, the logging industry has always been big in Vermont, agriculture, farming. So farmyards, threshing, sugaring, you know, collecting maple syrup. So kind of reflecting those themes and bringing them together, so you can start to think about, you know, a lot of those depictions are artists who were seeing these ways of life going away as they were working in the mid-20th century. And so now we can look back, 75 years down the road and say a lot of these things have been largely lost, or at least they've changed dramatically in the ways in which we go about logging or traditional farming, those sorts of things. Not everything is lost, but, you know, it is a collection that very much reflects a moment in time. But I think Lyman is very much interested in, and I think hopefully the exhibition does this well, is to say that, you know, looking back is also a way of looking forward. You preserve the past in order to think about what's important for the future of Vermont. And then the last section, actually, which we're sitting in now, is a section called Coming Together, about Vermont people coming together for all sorts of reasons: festivals, carnivals, family gatherings, auction houses. Auctions were a big theme for Lyman, because it's something that he's been attending for the last 50 years in order to acquire these paintings.
Again, the exhibit, For the Love of Vermont, will have a soft opening at the Bennington Museum starting July 1st, when about 50 of the paintings will be available for viewing. The exhibit will formally open there on July 15th. The Southern Vermont Art Center's portion of the exhibit will open on July 22nd. Both will be on display until November 5th. And the Manchester Community Library will host an event from 5 to 7 p.m. on June 28th that will involve both Lyman Wharton and Anita Raphael. There will be a slide presentation on the collection, and the event is open to the public and free of charge. For the GNET TV News Project, I'm Andrew McKeever. The Alliance for Community Media, or ACM, held its annual national conference in Brooklyn, New York, from June 27th to the 29th, and three members of the GNAT team attended it, along with more than 500 other people involved in community access media stations from across the country. The conference was held at the studios of BRIC, short for Brooklyn Information and Culture, the borough's Community Access Media headquarters. Founded in 1976, the Alliance represents over 3,000 public, educational, and governmental, or PEG, access organizations and community media centers throughout the country. The ACM works to protect the interests of these access centers and those who use PEG facilities and equipment to advance their causes through cable television and the Internet. The conference offered speaker events, panel discussions, and breakout sessions to give participants a chance to hear not only about national issues affecting all media centers, but also about particular issues impacting stations regionally. With an ongoing evolution of community media underway, where many viewers no longer access their local community media through cable television, as cord cutting continues, there was much discussion around how that will play out looking ahead. Finding other revenue streams, artificial intelligence, and new technology were also highlighted during the conference's several panel discussions. We had a chance to speak with Mike Wassenaar, the president of ACM, during a break in the action.
So I think the main challenge for organizations is having the resources to be able to do the work to reach people. In a lot of communities, there isn't local production of news happening. You're seeing news deserts evolve in a lot of communities. Part of it's because of the economics, right, for these commercial operations. For the non-commercial operations, they're mission-driven. They care very, very deeply about the information well-being of people locally. But having the local resources to be able to do that work and to distribute it is a challenge. And the other challenge is that not everybody is using the same kind of device to be able to get their information. The ways that we get useful information are, I think, more highly varied than at any point in time in recent history, whether it be radio or, you know, flyering that people do or television channels. You know, broadcast television in and of itself isn't the dominant media anymore, and neither is cable television. So finding audiences that will find meaning in the work people are doing is a huge challenge. And I think it's the number one, two, and three challenge for most of the operations here. It's just very, very different, because historically, they were often speaker platforms rather than engagement platforms. And if you're just there to get up on a soapbox to speak, it's one thing. But to make a meaningful connection with other people, it takes time and effort and resources. And I think that those are kind of the challenges that people face.
But it wasn't all about technology. One panel discussion, for example, looked at gun violence and what could be done and what role the media could play.
So the thing to know about gun violence and violence in general is that 85% of the people who are perpetrators of gun violence were actually victims of some form of violence before they became perpetrators. So you can see there's like this cycle that can kind of happen in that way. The other part to violence and gun violence in particular is that we see it through a dual lens. Yes, there are homicides, but there are also suicides. So of the people who are impacted by gun violence as suicide, over 80% of them are successful, meaning suicide by gun is the highest rate of self-inflicted injury. What does that mean exactly? That means we have a gun challenge in this country. Recognizing that America is built and has this desire to have access to guns, and rightfully so in some cases, where you need to protect yourselves, or let's say you find hunting to be a sport. Cali doesn't take a position on access to guns, but we do take a position on gun safety, advocating for guns to be safely stored, for them to be kept away from children, for them to be kept away from people who would harm others.
And then there were the networking opportunities. Like every similar conference, often the best value comes out of the one-on-one hallway conversations, where people who work at different stations have a chance to exchange ideas and information. Brooklyn, New York is a long way from southwestern Vermont, both in terms of miles and culture. GNET's executive director, Tammy Riley, talked about the conference and her takeaways.
So what really struck me after the week was the deep discussions that were had around community storytelling and how community media can be a space for community conversation and social journalism and storytelling for healing. I found that really interesting. And the staff and I are going to chew on that idea for a little bit over the next few months and see how we can deliver some new programming to our community that revolves around community conversations. So I'm really excited about that piece of it. And I think the AI conversations were really interesting for us as well, because it's so new and people are a little afraid of it. And it, the conversations around the AI and how it's being used for art and media were also really interesting. So we're going to take a look at that and see how we can bring those conversations to internally for the staff to use as well as to the community. So there was a lot of really great conversations and topics this year, which I'm really excited about and was a pleasure to be a part of.
The Alliance for Community Media is a national membership organization that advocates, promotes, and preserves the right to media training, production, distribution, civic engagement, and education in support of diverse community voices through public, education, and government access channels and other forms of media. Its goals include promoting free speech and civic engagement through local media. The Northeast Regional Conference of the ACM will be held this year in Burlington this November, and will be another chance to learn from colleagues doing the same important work as we do here at GNET TV. And for the GNET TV News Project, I'm Andrew McKeever. A CSA has by now become a fairly familiar acronym to many Vermonters and others who frequent farmers markets. It stands for Community Supported Agriculture, a system where community members or customers of a farm, often but not always growers of organic produce or something close to it, agree to acquire a certain amount of produce each week or month to help the farm sustain its operations. Up in South Londonderry, a farm has added a twist to this. The Anjali Farm grows a variety of medicinal plants, along with other vegetables, and offers what could be called a community-supported apothecary. Lenny Mazumdar and Helena Wu explained what they do.
Okay, well, I think we've both had experience with vegetable CSAs, and we wanted to do something different, and because we were all herbalists, we said, well, let's try an herbal CSA. And just expose people to the range of things that you can do with plants, you know, to improve your health. And so we decided to do it.
Yeah, during COVID, we started having meetings, and it was also a nice way to get together with people that were nearby and that we knew were safe to hang out with. Although we did a lot on Zoom as well, mm-hmm. a lot of our meetings on Zoom. But, you know, we all wanted to do something good for the community and something different, and this was like the obvious thing to start doing. I have a line of products called Lotus Moon Medicinals, which I've been making since 1997, started in Arlington, in fact, and on Wild Farm. And then Emmett grows a bunch of different, in addition to vegetables, he grows herbs as well as do I. And so making products and having products in a bag to pick up once a month seemed like a great thing to do. There were also, you know, cut flowers in the bag. There were, you want to mention some of the things you put in?
Yeah, we had salves and sprays and lotion. We made bath salts. Tea. And spice blends and teas.
Tinctures.
Yeah, tinctures, syrups, vinegars, honeys, quite a wide range, because I think that was one of my goals anyway, is to really show people that you can do a lot of things with the plants. And yeah, just to give them a taste of that. And also try to address common ailments people might have that are easily taken care of with plants. So, you know, a tummy ache or a headache or a irritating rash or something like that, that you could use these plants that you can find either wildcrafting, you know, that grow wild, or growing your own self and then making the products. And I also really love teaching classes. So in the past, I've offered lots of classes of how to just do these things on your own.
She walks you around her garden and outdoors, and she can do a wild plant identification walk. And then also Helena teaches on how to make these products.
But, you know, if I was going to, like, I make a spray that's good for poison ivy, helping dry that up. And so I know the plant. Jewelweed is the main ingredient. And sometimes I'll put plantain. Sometimes I'll mix it up different formulas. But herbs in there to help, you know, soothe the itch and pain and dry up the poison ivy. So if I know those plants, and then I know how to prepare them. So usually if I'm making a spray, I'll make a tincture. So that could either be macerating or dissolving, soaking the plants in alcohol, or vinegar. You could use vinegar as well. And then straining it out, and then you might put some more water because it's a little stingy when you spray it on. And then put that in a spray bottle. So easy.
So,
and we have some shares that came from far away, requests that came from far away, so we call them ship shares, so we could ship them to, we had a person from Chicago, another one from Rhode Island, a couple from Rhode Island, another one from New York. So we would ship shares as well, since it was just once a month. And the products are, you know, they can last. So that was the other novel thing about this CSA, is that it was a shippable share.
Right. And for the local people, we could also put in fresh products. So plants in the beginning of the season, plants, and then later on, like the fresh herbs, something like that, or an herbal bouquet, or, you know, whatever we could think up. It stretches our creativity as well.
Helena has a big medicinal and vegetable garden at home with her partner. So she sources a lot of her herbs from there. I do a lot of wildcrafting, and I grow a few herbs that I know I use, like calendula and holy basil, arnica.
And you focus also on the food and the Ayurvedic aspect.
So I'm an Ayurvedic tradition. Yes, I'm an Ayurvedic nutrition counselor, and I have a little cooking side business, as you know. But you guys, I can't believe how many people watched that show and told me about it. It's embarrassing. Anyway, it was fun. But I also do a lot of food, and a lot of this kind of stuff will go into my tiffins in the summertime. We have a lot of container gardening going on here this year. And so, yes, I would make spice mixes, and I would actually also give people different, we'd have, at pickups, we would have potluck sometimes. Mm-hmm. And so we'd give people food out as well.
Yeah. And I think, you know, one thing about Ayurveda is the seasonal aspect of it. So different herbs are for different seasons. You would use them more, you know, like in the summer, you want more cooling things. In the winter, you want more warming things. So Linny knows all about that, and she adjusts her food that she makes to take that into account. Or if she is doing a consultation with you, you know, she's looking at those kinds of things too.
And also food comes up seasonally, as you know, from growing a garden. You know, first are the lettuces. Well, the strawberries will come early. Lettuces come up right away. Our fall vegetables come later, so you're eating them later, you know, so there's also seasonality to how food grows, just like the herbs in the wild.
Lenny also runs a wellness center in South Londonderry, a short distance away, which uses their produce.
That kind of stuff. The magic. The potions and lotions. Here I am. I made some scar healing salve this morning. And what I used in there was some St. John's wort. These are picked last summer. And arnica, which I grew. And those are in olive oil that I've had soaking. I also use calendula oil and comfrey oil. And then I put some beeswax in here, melt it. This is all measured out, of course. Beeswax, melt that, add the oils into that, and when it's all nicely melted together, I just pour them into these little jars. And then I have lids that I put on and a label that I'll put on. And voila, there you go. You have a product that you can use for your skin to heal scars. And my business is, my business is lotusmoonvermont.com.
It's a bit of a change of gears for a CSA, but one that works. For the GNAT TV News Project, I'm Andrew McKeever. Road crews and emergency workers were keeping busy digging out or cleaning out after a rainstorm, often compared to Tropical Storm Irene, dumped up to 8 inches of rainfall across southern Vermont starting on Sunday, July 9th. The rain continued on through Monday, July 10th, and in several places, rivers and streams crested early Tuesday morning. The sun was out on Tuesday, the 11th, helping to dry things out, but that only helped bring the extent of the storm into clearer focus. Hardest hit were some of the mountain towns, especially Weston and Londonderry, which were all but cut off after severe damage was inflicted on several roads leading in and out of those communities. Farther north, Ludlow was also severely flooded. Town officials are urging motorists to take seriously the road closed signs and avoid unnecessary travel in areas most severely impacted by the flooding. On Sunday, Governor Phil Scott declared a state of emergency, calling in swift water and rescue assets from states with which Vermont has a mutual aid agreement. State officials have also urged residents to evacuate their homes if there's a threat of high water nearby, and to operate generators safely with an eye towards preventing carbon monoxide poisoning. You can sign up for up-to-the-minute weather alerts at vem.vermont.gov/VT alert. For the GNAT TV News Project, I'm Andrew McKeever.